So today what I wanted to talk about is a problem that, or a question that often doesn't get raised in connection with thinking about immaterial beings. So we do a lot of philosophical thinking about whether there is such a thing as an immaterial entity, God or the human soul or an angel. There's also plenty of arguing about whether minds or consciousness are immaterial or whether they're reducible to physical structures. But for all of that investigation of whether specific entities are immaterial or non-physical, there's not a lot of thinking about what exactly the concept of immateriality itself amounts to, and therefore what it would even mean in the first place to claim that something is immaterial. So what I want to do in this talk is step back from the usual question, is some X immaterial, and ask instead the question, what is immateriality? And what are our unstated expectations for what it would even mean to answer such a question? So I'm going to focus, of course, on Thomas Aquinas. And in the first section, I'm going to give what I think is a common assumption about immaterial being, common associations that people have popularly and even in the philosophical literature. And I'm going to call that the spooky body concept of immateriality. That's going to be section one. And then in the second section of the paper, I'm going to talk about what I think is a competing view of immateriality that we can find in Thomas Aquinas, which I'm going to call the self-manifesting view of immaterial being. And this is related to a book project that I'm working on right now on Aquinas and his Greek and Arabic sources. So in this paper, it is not my goal to convince you that anything immaterial exists, but simply to set up some different concepts of immateriality and show that in Aquinas, we have something that's actually an interesting alternative to common assumptions about what immateriality is. But of course, it would be a shame if we didn't get a little bit of chance to see how Aquinas argues that the human intellect or the human mind is immaterial. So at the end of the talk, I'm just going to briefly run through his one of his neglected arguments on that point. All right, so the spooky body conception of immateriality. So let's begin by considering some portrayals of what I think is a common view of immateriality, which I call the spooky body view. And what better place to turn than to the ghost-obsessed Victorian era? In Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, we find this masterfully witty description of the ghost of Jacob Marley. Dickens writes, "The same face, the very same. Marley, in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tight, and boots, the tassels on the ladder bristling like his pigtail, and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through the waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind." Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he had never believed it until now. No, nor did he believe it even now, though he looked the phantom through and through and saw it standing before him. You can see Dickens describing the ghost of Marley behaving with great propriety according to all the ghostly conventions. The laws governing the interaction of bodies appear to have no purchase on him at all. He arrives in Scrooge's dingy little flat by passing directly through the door, and he departs through the window and vanishing into thin air. Nonetheless, Dickens imagines him as something like a body in all respects, transparent to be sure, but extended, moving across the room, taking up space, a whole composed of ghostly extended parts, characterized by the same, the very same shapes, textures, and proportions as Marley's living body. Dickens is not unaware of the metaphysical tensions, and indeed he positively revels in them. Quote, Can you sit down? Asked Scrooge, looking doubtfully at him. He didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair, and found that in the event of its being impossible, it might involve the necessity of an embarrassing explanation. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if he were quite used to it. Well, that's lucky. Ghost sits down in chair by fireplace, embarrassing explanation avoided. And what Dickens captures is our ingrained imaginative tendency to imagine immateriality as a kind of anomalous materiality. We can't help but imagine immaterial entities as material bodies except less substantial, and thwarting as much as possible our expectations of how bodies should interact with other bodies. You can think also, there's a very old sort of imaginative way of thinking about the immaterial. So if we think about Homer's shades, similarly, the attempt to clasp the shades fails. They have this sort of thinness and lack of substantiality, but they still have a kind of bodily shape. Such spooky bodies are not merely confined to the poetic imagination. We can find them wandering around in broad daylight in our own philosophical precincts. So in Consciousness Explained, Daniel Dennett asserts that defenders of a non-physicalist account of the human mind are forced to attribute two contradictory properties to the mind or soul. On the one hand, unlike a material thing, it permeates the body. On the other hand, like a material thing, it is able to interact with the body. Notice this is just exactly the same sort of imaginative way of thinking about immateriality as we saw above. And Dennett draws an explicit comparison to the comic strip Casper the Ghost, in which Casper the Ghost can go through walls, but when necessary, he can catch a falling object. And I think this way of imagining the immaterial soul or angels, I would argue, is also widespread in Christian contexts. So this spooky body approach to immateriality has the following three features, and those are listed on your handout, which is basically a summary of the key points and passages. So first, you have a notion of immateriality that's a notion of weirdly behaving materiality in which certain features of material bodies are disrupted or altered, especially those associated with mass, so weight and impenetrability in particular. Secondly, the negative characteristic of masslessness veers in the imagination into becoming a positive feature of immaterial being. So we imagine a kind of airy thinness or transparency or penetrability or fluidity of form. And there's a third important feature here, and that's that the spooky body view detaches immaterial being from mental activity. So a spooky body does not need to be a thinking sort of body. You can imagine it makes perfect sense to think of a ghost ship or Macbeth's dagger that he imagines he tries to, the ghost dagger that he tries to grasp. And this is going to be important for reasons that will become clear later. Now let's suppose that we're all assuming the spooky body, model of immateriality. What would it mean, assuming that perspective of immateriality, to ask the question, is the mind or is something immaterial or material? Well, notice that on the spooky body view, we're starting with two categories that are already filled in, a kind of notion, positive, contentful notion of materiality, extended stuff, and then another notion, which is something other than that, something so strange and unfamiliar that we have a hard time conceptualizing what it even is. So a prominent historian of medieval philosophy, Bob Paznow, writes, and this is in defense of the notion of immaterial being, he says, "It seems to me we can most effectively capture the notion of an immaterial realm of entities by allowing for a variety of possible ways in which the world might be, such that if there were entities like that, then it would be right to think of the world as carved up into two kinds, the familiar material kind and a distinct weird kind of entity so different from what we're familiar with as to go into a fundamentally different category of being." So if we're, notice one of them we've got empirical familiarity with, the other one we have no empirical familiarity with. So if we're asked, is the mind material or immaterial, then the question amounts to asking, which of those categories, preformed categories, does the mind inhabit? The familiar one, the empirically accessible one, we normally understand how bodies work, or the weird one, the non-empirically accessible bodies with spooky properties. So notice the procedure. First, we posit a set of spooky properties, even though we've never experienced anything with those properties. Then we construct a notion of immateriality as the stuff with those properties. And then we ask, could the mind be a spooky thing made of this weird stuff? So we can see that that approach already doesn't sound very promising. But it gets even worse. Remember that third characteristic of the spooky body view, that imagining immaterial entities as weird bodies, we give ourselves no reason to think that an immaterial thing must be a thinker. You can have a ghost ship or a phantom dagger. But if we get into the habit of thinking of all the reality there is as a kind of lifeless stuff, whether the normal or the spooky kind, then we can't help treating the mind as a kind of producer of consciousness, a kind of lifeless mechanism that projects our conscious experience from behind the scenes, as it were. And if that's the framework we're operating in, then the question, is the mind immaterial, boils down to a question about what is the stuff that is the behind-the-scenes producer of consciousness? Can consciousness be sufficiently explained as the work of a physical stuff, an observable sort of stuff, or do we need to call in some invisible spooky stuff mechanism to produce consciousness? So the question is thus set up in terms of two ways of filling an explanatory gap. Either we trust that familiar physical stuff is more powerful than we understand, or we invoke some other immaterial kind of being which looks suspiciously as if it were cooked up precisely to fill that explanatory gap. So asserting that the mind is immaterial within this framework begins to look like a kind of admission of defeat. So whether you think the mind is immaterial or not, I think it's important to keep in mind how high the cost is of approaching immateriality this way. And it's not surprising that nearly any other explanation of conscious experience seems preferable to having to posit that the mind has this kind of spooky reality. Part two, Aquinas' self-manifesting being. Luckily, other models are available. One alternative is what I would call, not at no cost, but at a different cost. One alternative is what I call the self-manifestation view of immateriality, which is represented by Thomas Aquinas. And the view has a long and illustrious pedigree going back to Alexander of Aphrodisias and running through the Arabic commentary tradition, but has rarely been remarked upon by contemporary historians of philosophy. So what I'm doing here is not just sketching an alternative picture of immateriality, but reconstructing a notion that I think has largely gone missing even from the historical literature. So in discussing Aquinas' notion of immateriality as self-manifestation, I'm going to use the terminology of intellect, which goes back to the Latin intellectus, instead of mind. And the reason is that for Aquinas, the notion of what we would now call mind is a very broad notion encompassing a lot of different cognitive powers. You have your sensory power, external sensory powers, of internal sensory powers like imagination and the faculty that's able to detect danger and benefit. And then you have this purely immaterial power for Aquinas, which is the one responsible for grasping the essences of things. So the fact that when you see some beautiful painting, you're able to grasp it as beautiful and to grasp what beauty is and try to formulate a definition of it, that's because your intellectual power is operating in that experience. That's the only cognitive power for Aquinas that's fully immaterial. And if we were to get into the question of what status these other sense powers have, they're not totally material, he says, but they're not totally immaterial. That's a very weird notion in its own right. We could talk about that all evening. So I'm only going to talk about the less problematic immateriality of intellect for this talk. All right, so what's distinctive about the self-manifesting view of immateriality in Aquinas is that it begins by construing knowing not as a function performed by a mechanism, but rather as a kind of being among other kinds of being in the natural world. So first, let's establish a frame of reference for talking about kinds of being. This might seem a little odd. So as Aquinas understands change, any time that you have a change occurring, some kind of being is taken away or added to a subject. So you take a pot of water, you put it on the stove, you turn the heat on. For Aquinas, metaphysically, what's happening is that the water, the subject, is acquiring some new being that it didn't have before, the being of heat, and it's losing one that it had previously, which is the being of cold. If I stay out in the, well, this is not going to happen to me in March, but if I stay out in the sun too long and my skin starts to get redder and redder, for Aquinas, that's to be construed in terms of my skin, the subject, acquiring the being of red and losing the being of paleness. Right? So any observable characteristics of a subject for Aquinas can always be understood in terms of gains and losses in the being that a subject has. And we become acquainted with the different kinds of being precisely due to our empirical encounters with things that have those kinds of being. So for instance, Aquinas asked, well, how do we get our concept of materiality? Right? Never mind immateriality for a second. How do we just get the concept of materiality? Well, he thinks that's because we encounter material things experientially through the senses. And when we trip over them or move them around, we're manipulating them in space. We experience them as having three dimensions. So he says, from that which exteriorly appears of a thing, we come to know the essence of a thing. And the name body is given to signify a certain genus of substances from the fact that they are found to have three dimensions. That they are found. That's important, right? This is something that we experience and we notice. So we trip over them, we bump over them, we wrap our hands around them, we cut them apart, we glue them together, we expend untold amounts of effort moving them from place to place. If you're an academic, this is a large chunk of your life, is schlepping your stuff from one city to another city. And it's in this experience of tripping and grasping and lifting and carrying that we encounter a certain kind of being, which is material or bodily being. Notice, Aquinas is not going to worry that materiality is some weird unknown reality hiding behind a kind of appearance of extension. Rather, extension is the distinctive characteristic of a material kind of being. And when I stumble over an extended body, that is my very experience of materiality. So what about the mind? Do we stumble across mental being anywhere? Or more specifically, do we stumble across intellectual being anywhere? And Aquinas says, yes, we do. We stumble across the mind, our own mind, whenever we're thinking about anything at all. So here's what he writes. Quote, the mind understands itself whenever it understands something. And then in another passage, he says, whoever understands or is illuminated knows that he understands or is illuminated because he knows the thing to be manifest to himself. So Aquinas is referring here, I would argue, to a phenomenon that we can call implicit self-awareness. And the phenomenon is this. So you can imagine that you have to picture yourself in the first person in this experience in order to get the right aspect that he wants to point to. So imagine yourself sitting at the desk, and you're busily writing away, and all of a sudden out of the corner of your eye you see something moving in the room, and then you see it's an enormous spider, and it's climbing up the corner of the wall. And suppose that you're absolutely terrified of spiders. So your attention is completely and totally fixed upon the spider in that moment, in such a way that it leaves no room for any consciousness of anything else, or so it seems. Now suppose that somebody comes into the room and distracts you and says, what are you looking at? And you turn around and say to them, oh, I was just looking at that spider. Do you see that spider in the room? I was just looking at it. You're, even though in the moment you are totally paying attention to the spider, you're able to communicate that experience from the first person perspective as something that you were experiencing in that moment. And for Aquinas, that's evidence that in the very moment that you are paying attention to the spider, you're also in some framing way aware of yourself as the one to whom the spider is manifest. You're not attending to yourself, but you've got some sort of polarity in the experience in which you're aware of yourself as the subject of that experience, even though your attention is totally focused on the spider. So that's a very interesting sort of phenomenon. And we might ask ourselves, why does this happen? Why are we implicitly self-aware whenever we're thinking of anything at all? And this is where we're going to get to some very technical details. I'm going to try to make it as clear as possible, but this is the sort of technical metaphysical stuff. So the reason for Aquinas is encapsulated in two claims. First of all, when we are thinking, so you're thinking about the spider, tending to it, We're acquiring a new kind of being that we did not have before, just like the water acquired heat or my skin acquired redness in the sun. The being we acquire is the being of thought. In other words, the consciousness of the spider is a new kind of being in me. And you might respond to him, but Aquinas, consciousness is different from being. Consciousness is just a phenomenon. We have this tendency to treat consciousness or experiences as somehow less real than reality. So imagine we say these things like, oh, that wasn't real, it was just all in his mind, that was just a dream, right? And we tend to assume, and this goes back to a distinction that's introduced in the late 13th and early 14th century, we tend to assume that there's a distinction between mental kinds of experiences and reality, which has sort of actual being. But that's not Aquinas' view. He thinks if there's any non-relational changes in the world, they have to be changes in being. And so our experiences are changes in being for us. So when I'm thinking spider, my thinking is some new being that I have acquired, spider thought. Now, and here's the second important point. This new kind of being, spider thought, is a rather surprising kind of being for Aquinas. It has two special, essential characteristics. It is both intellectual, thinking kind of being, and intelligible, the being thought kind of being. Here's what he says in Summa Contra Gentiles 151. The actual intelligible is the actual intellect. But according as intelligible and intellect are distinct from each other, both are in potency, just as is clear in the case of sense. And the point is this. The being that I acquire, spider thought, has a twofold character. It is the knowing kind of being, intellectual being, and the being known kind of being. That's one and the same kind of being with two characteristics. So intellectuality and intelligibility are just two sides of the same coin for Aquinas. And he explains this in an extended passage of his commentary on the Metaphysics. He says, Aristotle says that it belongs to the nature of the intellect that it should understand itself insofar as it takes on or conceives in itself something intelligible. For the intellect becomes intelligible by attaining something intelligible. And therefore, because the intellect becomes intelligible in conceiving something intelligible, it follows that intellect and intelligible are the same. Now, this might sound weird because we're used to what might be called a relational account of knowing. We think of knowing and being known as belonging to two different things. I'm the one knowing. The spider over there in the corner is what's being known. Subject, object. And we expect that what makes something be a mind is its ability to be put into a mental kind of relation to something other than itself, to the spider. We also say that we might say something like, a spider is intelligible to a scientist, meaning if a scientist were to come along, the scientist would be able to study it. But Aquinas is working from a very different paradigm, which I call a metaphysical approach. For Aquinas, there is no thought that is not also a thinker. There is no thinker that is not also a thought. So to say that something is intelligible for Aquinas is not to describe it in relation to some possible thinker. Someone could come along and know it. Rather, it's to describe a kind of being that is manifesting itself. And the one to whom it is manifesting itself is that very being itself. He's describing a kind of self-luminosity or self-manifestation of this really special kind of being, which I'm calling self-manifesting being. So the idea is that as human beings, we naturally have a potential to acquire self-manifesting being, and when we have it, that's when we're thinking. Indeed, it just is our very experience of thinking. There's another text on this, but it's a little long, so I'm going to skip it. So crucially, Aquinas describes the intellectual potency and the intelligible actuality as together forming something one and perfect. So let's see how this applies to the spider So for Aquinas, if I'm watching the spider and understanding in that moment what spiders are, that means that a new kind of being, a spidery kind of being, has taken up residence in me. This is kind of a horrifying thought, actually. So this spidery kind of being is not a real spider, luckily, but it is a spidery intelligible being, a being known, that is also a spidery thinker, me constituted as knower. And to put it another way, I know spiders in virtue of becoming spiderified, namely by acquiring a spidery self-manifesting being. And again, I'm skipping the text, which is De Veritate 8.6, which is a pretty awesome text, but long again. So in short, Aquinas would explain my knowing of spiders and my knowing of myself in that context as my acquiring a kind of being that is an episode of spidery self-manifestation. That's what it means for me to know spiders. So it's important to emphasize here that self-manifesting being is a real kind of being in the world alongside being hot, being human, being extended, being fragile, etc. And this approach has two important implications for our purposes. First of all, Aquinas resists the now common tendency to treat the mental as not counting ontologically, the tendency to speak of a mere experience as distinct from the ontological stuff that produces conscious experience, as though experience itself or ideas or quality or phenomenal feel, appearances, has no ontological status in its own right. Furthermore, and this I think is a really interesting implication of the view, the implications of positing self-manifesting kind of being in the natural world run much deeper than just explaining implicit self-awareness. Because self-manifesting being is not just supposed to explain why I'm aware of myself when I'm paying attention to the spider, but it's also supposed to explain why the spider is manifest to me at all. So there's only a spidery self-manifestation because of this kind of being that has taken up residence in me. So spiders only become known if spiderness acquires a self-manifesting being in me or in someone else. So to put it more provocatively, spiderness only becomes manifest to itself as an actuality of my or someone else's intellectual potency. So you might say, my spider thought is an episode of spider self-knowing. Just keeps getting worse. At this point, so we might say that the intellectual animal then is the place where the world of matter and motion becomes aware of itself. And there's a formulation in Charles Kahn talking about Aristotle that makes that point, and I think that's something that Aquinas picks up as well. So at this point, you might be thinking that you'd rather have the ghost back. Maybe that was a better view. But let's summarize the essentials of this self-manifesting view in a tamer way. We could do that as follows in 3 points. First of all, there's a kind of being that's manifest to itself, or self-manifesting. That's intellectual being. Secondly, I encounter this kind of being whenever I'm thinking, insofar as I myself am self-aware whenever I'm thinking. So I asked at the beginning of this section, do we stumble across the mind anywhere? Do we have any experiences, concretely, of intellectual being? And now we see that for Aquinas, the answer is, of course, yes. We experience intellectual being, or rather, it experiences itself whenever it's actualized, whenever we're thinking. We don't stumble across it from the outside, that's the important difference, but rather we stumble across it as from the inside in its manifestation to itself, or my manifestation to myself in the first person. Thirdly, self-manifestation is not a kind of phenomenal sheen or appearance behind which the real intellect resides. Rather, the intellectual being I acquire when I'm thinking, whether that's intellectual treeness or spiderness or triangularity, is essentially self-manifesting all the way down. And I said there were 3 points, but I lied, there's actually 4. But the 4th point is that anything that has this sort of being must be manifest to itself. And since we're only sometimes manifest to ourselves, namely whenever we're actually thinking about it, something, that means for Aquinas that we only sometimes have actual intellectual being, when we're having an occurrent thought. So now let's return to our question, is the mind immaterial? And immediately we see that when we pose this question in the context of Aquinas' notion of self-manifesting being, the question has a very different force from what it means when it's posed in the context of this spooky body view. So the reason is this. Remember that when we had the spooky body view in place, when we asked the question, is mind immaterial? We started from a position of, first of all, not knowing what kind of being the mind has. And secondly, already having some positive notion of immateriality filled in with these spooky properties that we've never experienced. So the question amounted to our asking, what kind of being should we attribute to the mind? The kind that's familiar from experience? Or some other weird kind of spooky being that we've never experienced but we cooked up to fill the explanatory gap? And we see that Aquinas does exactly the opposite. He starts from a position of, first of all, knowing from experience already what kind of being the mind has. It has self-manifesting being. And secondly, having a negative concept of materiality. So let's talk about both of those sort of features of Aquinas' account in more detail. Regarding the first, recall that in reflecting on the being of mind, we started from an ordinary experience of implicit self-awareness. In the act of knowing, I'm lit up to myself as the one knowing. This implicit self-awareness is just my experience of self-manifesting being. It's as much an experience as my tripping over a chair is my experience of material being. So intellectual or self-manifesting being is just another ordinary guy on the roster of beings that we encounter in the world around us and the world in us. It is not, to borrow again Pazno's words, a distinct weird kind of entity so different from what we're familiar with as to go into a fundamentally different category of being. Its properties may seem curiouser and curiouser as we investigate them more and more closely, just like the properties of material being, you could think quantum mechanics. Nonetheless, for Aquinas, it's one of the kinds of beings we experience. Regarding the second point, Aquinas maintains a purely negative concept of immateriality. The word immaterial means nothing more or less than simply not material, lacking extension in three dimensions. That is all the word means for Aquinas. There's no additional content. So from this position, when Aquinas asks, is the mind material or immaterial, the question is going to amount to something very different from what we have seen so far. What he's really asking is, where does this familiar kind of being that we encounter within ourselves when we're thinking, self-manifesting being, where does this familiar kind of being fit in the taxonomy of real beings? Is it a subset of extended being, or does it occupy a kind of class of its own? Is it the same sort of thing as a table, or not? Or to put it another way, is self-manifesting being extended in three dimensions, or not? That's the question. So to say that self-manifesting being is immaterial is simply to answer the question no, to deny that this familiar kind of being is extended. It's not to ascribe any extra spooky properties that we haven't experienced. So by analogy, imagine an entomologist who's concluding a 5-year study of the black widow spider. People must do this. And then suppose the entomologist asks, are these spider behaviors that I've been observing, are these non-rational behaviors? Suppose that's the question. So to assert their non-rational behaviors isn't to attribute them to some extra properties, but rather just to say that these spider behaviors, the objects of empirical study, are not included among what we understand to be rational behaviors. In order to justify claiming that spider behaviors are non-rational, the entomologist merely has to show that these two empirically familiar behaviors, rational behaviors, and spider behaviors, are incompatible with each other. And that's exactly what Aquinas does when he's arguing for the immateriality of self-manifesting being. His project is of showing that there's these two empirically familiar kinds of being, self-manifesting being and extended material being, have properties that are incompatible with each other. So they belong in different classes rather than one being a subset of the other. So I promised that we'd conclude by talking a bit about why Aquinas therefore thinks that self-manifesting being cannot be extended. And if you've read any Aquinas before on the immateriality of the soul, you might have looked at texts from the Summa Theologiae and the Summa Contra Gentiles, where he lays out a lot of theories and a lot of arguments, and mostly the arguments that people focus on, especially in the literature, are arguments around the universality of thought, the fact that you're able to grasp essences with your intellect. But it's often overlooked that he has an argument that occurs twice in his writing, once in the commentary on the Liber de Causis and once in the Summa Contra Gentiles, where he argues that the intellect cannot be material because it's self-reflexive in exactly the self-manifesting way. The text from the commentary on the Liber de Causis is there on the handout, and I'm just going to read it real quickly and summarize what I think the argument is trying to say, because I think it illustrates the strategy I've just been describing. So he says, no body naturally turns to itself. This is a description of turning to itself, it's just having reflexivity. For since what is turned to something else is conjoined to that which is turned, to which it is turned, obviously all the corporeal parts of a body that is turned to itself will have to be conjoined to all the parts, which is impossible in things made up of parts because of the separation of the parts, with different parts lying in different places. So the evidence that intelligence is not a body is the return upon its essence, namely that it is turned back upon itself, understanding itself, which befits it because it is not a body or magnitude having one part distant from another, such that one of its extremities would follow the other as distinct from the other with respect to position. It's these sorts of texts that make you pull your hair out when you're reading Aquinas, but that's what one loves about him. The argument in this text in broad strokes goes like this. One, X is self-manifesting if and only if it appropriates itself whole by whole. Two, no extended substance can appropriate itself whole by whole, since the parts get in the way of each other. Three, therefore, no extended substance can be a self-manifesting being. What's going on here? What Aquinas is saying is that self-manifestation implies the presence of the whole to the whole, through and through. So the whole of a self-manifesting being has to be equally knower and equally known all the way through. Otherwise, there would be one part that is knowing and the other part that is known, and the knowing part would approach the known part from the outside and grasp it as it, always from the outside in the third person. So in order to have self-manifestation properly speaking, the whole has to be at once knower and known, through and through. But since anything that's extended in three dimensions, like this desk, is divisible into parts, and no two extended parts can exist in the same place, then it's impossible for an extended whole to reappropriate the entire whole. The extension of its parts is always going to get in the way. And we can see this by imagining trying to cause a paper, this piece of paper, wholly to appropriate itself, whole by whole. It's not possible, because every time you have to imagine you're trying to fold it, you can get one part in contact with another part, but you can never get the whole in contact with the whole. So for Aquinas, that's a feature of extension as such. It's precisely because it's extended in three dimensions that one part can only contact another part, but the whole cannot be in contact with the whole. So as a result, for Aquinas, now we've got an essential feature of extended being that's incompatible with self-manifestation. And that's the basis then for his arguing that a self-manifesting kind of being cannot be an extended kind of being because they have incompatible properties. Okay. Aquinas underscores this point in a rare moment of fun. I just want to read you this text because I can't really miss it. in which he proposes a quirky thought experiment. And this is my favorite text in the works of Aquinas, actually. So he says, if a box were to subsist by itself without matter, imagine an immaterial box, it would be self-understanding. For freedom from matter implies intelligibility. And hence, an immaterial box would be the same as an intelligible or self-manifesting box. So what it would mean to be an immaterial box would just to be a self-aware box. And the idea is, you could say it's a case of self-knowing. But the idea would simply be that each of these kinds of being has an essential property that's incompatible with the other kind of being. Anything that's not a body is self-manifesting. Anything that's not self-manifesting is a body. Those are the only two basic kinds of reality that there are. And that means that a Platonic form, on Aquinas' view, would have to be a thinker. That's exactly what he thinks an angel is, in fact. All right. So let me draw attention to three main features in conclusion of Aquinas' self-manifestation approach to immateriality, which differ from the three features of the spooky body approach that I mentioned earlier. First of all, the spooky body concept of immateriality began from our experience of material things and hypothesized what kinds of properties an immaterial thing might have. In contrast, the self-manifestation view starts from our experiencing of knowing as a kind of real being with properties that we experience from the first-person perspective. Second, the spooky body concept of immateriality includes spooky properties that are posited in order to account for the phenomena, but that are not part of our experience. In contrast, the self-manifestation model does not attribute to an immaterial being any properties that go beyond our experience of living an intellectual life. Third, the spooky body concept of immateriality is applicable to things that are not minds. In contrast, on Aquinas' self-manifestation model, immateriality is conceptualized as essentially cognitive or mental. Whatever is immaterial is manifest to itself all the way through. So there's no differentiation here between mind and its thoughts, or mind and its ideas, or mind and consciousness. When we acquire intellectual being, that just is an episode of self-manifesting consciousness. So the cost of integrating the self-manifesting kind of immateriality into an ontology is relatively low. Aquinas' self-manifestation model of immateriality simply makes the claim that one of the kinds of realities that we encounter in our trek through life is a non-extended reality. Thank you very much.
So we are opening up for questions.
I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the actual intelligible, the actual intellect. So the thing, I think I might still be thinking in the terms of subject and object.
Yes.
But when we appropriate the, I guess, the intelligible thing, is that intelligible? So the intelligible thing is not the same thing as the extended substance,
right?
Right.
Right.
But when we know the thing and act, do we in any way affect the extended substance, or are we only affecting the intelligible?
So, yeah, that's a good question. So Aquinas says we're never affecting the extended thing. The extended thing is affecting us. It's causing knowledge in us, right? So the change is all happening to us, not to it. But it's also the case for Aquinas, is it's not like we've got, and here's how you're right to point out that you're still sort of using this notion of subject and object, because our natural inclination is to say, okay, I get it. The intelligible is not that thing there, which is somehow changed by being known, and then we bring it inside the mind. We still have two things sort of pasted together. Here's my intellect, which is a knower, and there's the intelligible, which is the known, right? And then we can ask, well, are you doing anything to the intelligible? And for Aquinas, that's the wrong way to think about it. They're just one and the same thing, which is just sort of self-luminous. So you want to, what he wants above all is to eliminate this idea that there's one thing that's approaching another from the outside. Even if they're just sort of pasted together, that's not good enough. They have to be just absolutely one and the same thing. So for him, the upshot of this is going to be, we don't have that kind of being at all. We don't have intellects, properly speaking, until we acquire intellectual, intelligible being. Right? What we have is a potency for that kind of being. but we don't really have like something that is a kind of intellect as a kind of thing or a faculty or a mini substance or anything like that.
Yeah, back there.
I just wanted to ask a little bit about memory in that case. If mm-hmm. the thing that is self-manifesting ceases to self-manifest, which it just says
yes.
that it's necessarily temporary, how does it then have knowledge the next time that it manifests?
Yeah, so Aquinas, when he talks about memory, he has this sort of note of insistence that indicates the extent to which this is a problem for him. Because he's drawing on a tradition in which the upshot of this is just simply to deny that there's anything like intellectual memory. It's like there's a light that's either switched on or it's switched off. And when it's switched on, that's when you're thinking. And then in that tradition, so in somebody like Avicenna, the memory is all put down into the inner senses. So it's really the imaginative memory. You remember your sense impressions of things, but you don't really have intellectual memory of what beauty is. And Aquinas thinks that's not quite right, but he has trouble with it. And so what he ends up saying is that our soul acquires dispositions to reactualize that kind of being in us. And that's what he wants to call intellectual memory. So we have a kind of, so he'll talk about preserving the intelligible species in habitu, so having a kind of intellectual habit. And what he means is it's like the skill in your, it's like the skill in your fingers for playing the piano when you're not playing, right? It's a kind of disposition in the fingers to actualize something, right? So it's not like we've got just a little bit of intellectual being hanging out in the bottom of the soul somewhere. You don't have any actuality there at all. You have a disposition to reactualize.
So that would be an extension? That would put memory into the form of that is extension?
He's still going to say that it's because the human soul is okay. Immaterial for him. Yes. So he's still going to say it's kind of like immaterial form in us. But if you're thinking that sounds like that could be a kind of problem, because then why isn't that a kind of self-manifestation? I think that's a sort of tension that he actually hasn't resolved in the theory.
Yep. This seems familiar to me to various anti-reductionist arguments that have been made in modern philosophy with regards
yes.
to mental cognition. What calls to mind is Thomas Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, which seems
yeah.
to be a derivative of this. And I'm wondering if you might be able to comment on the way in which this idea has been used in modern philosophy
mm-hmm.
And how it's been molded and such.
Yeah, so the two natural kind of conversation partners for the kind of project we see in Aquinas it are Searle and Galen Strawson. And both of those projects are in different ways ones of expanding the ontology. To say, well, we've had an overly narrow, and there you've got a kind of, you know, still operating within a kind of materialist framework to say, we just don't have a broad enough concept of what material reality is capable of, right? And so there's a way of expanding out material reality. And I think what Aquinas is doing is, he's not expanding material reality as such, but he's expanding our notion of reality. Because the sort of common element there is the recognition that when we're talking about mental being, we've sort of made some kind, we've gotten ourselves in a bind precisely because we've stopped thinking of it as real being. We treat it as a kind of mere phenomenon, right? And then we're looking for what the being is underneath. It's projecting that. So that's where I think there's a kind of natural resonance with some of these other projects.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is kind of working on the question about inner sense as well. So it seems like, we've been talking about the intellectual and the material here, but then this kind of this third category, which is the sensory.
Yeah.
I guess it's a worry about the self-reflexivity arguments.
Yes.
So it's kind of clear with universality arguments why sense perception doesn't apply. But then, if we're talking about the inner sense, there does seem to be this kind of self-reflexivity to it.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're seeing that you're seeing red.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of wondering how is that going to be distinct from the intellectual.
Yeah. Good. I think this is an area in which Aquinas wants to depart from some of his contemporaries' views on the matter for reasons of maintaining the kind of embodiedness of human existence, but he causes some problems for himself in this realm. So there's some of his contemporaries hold that sensation, any kind of cognitive reality is purely immaterial, and it's something that is a kind of modification of the human soul. So it doesn't matter whether it's sense or imagination or intellect, these are all immaterial kinds of modifications of the soul. And Aquinas doesn't want to do that because he thinks that sensation is an actuality of an organ. So it's really, when you're sensing, that's not something that's sort of happening in the soul being triggered by something happening in the eye. It's really a kind of perfection of the eye, the visual system, the optic nerve and all that, to be seeing, right? However, if it's a perfection of a body, that means it's extended, so it looks like it can't be self-reflexive. And throughout his career, starting in about the 1250s, he starts trying out different ways of getting around this. I don't think he ever fully works out a way that is satisfactory to even to himself of exactly how to deal with the reflexivity of sense. But he develops this language in the 1250s that he rejects and then he picks back up, which is this idea that sense is partially reflexive. So he distinguishes a kind of full reflexivity in which the intellect is totally the intelligible and therefore can the whole is in possession of the whole. But he thinks that in the sense, what you have is that the activity of sense is self-reflexive, but not in such a way that the sense is able to grasp itself. It's just that the activity is somehow reflexive, but there isn't any possibility in the sense of formulating a first personal kind of dimension to the experience. But I think what he's going for is, if you just lost your intellect, you would still be conscious, and he wants to address that as a kind of lower level reflexivity, but all of your experience would be formulated in the third person. Yeah, I think that's the view, but he doesn't quite have a fully worked out theory of it.
So it's, you're seeing that seeing red, you wouldn't say that I'm seeing myself seeing red.
Yes, right, that's how he wants.
This is probably out of context, this is probably a misunderstanding and misapplying it, but I read it, so I'm going to ask it anyway. It's from Aquinas. It says, the image of God is realized principally in an act of contemplation in the intellect. Mm-hmm. What's he mean by that in relation to this discussion tonight?
Yeah, good. So so he talks about, so when people look at the intellect in Aquinas, they tend to go bottom up. We start with, there's bodies, some of them are alive, then there's animals, which also sense, and then sensation can be more or less sophisticated. You've got the external senses, the internal senses, they're all bodily realities, and on top of all of that, then you have this purely intellectual capacity of the human person, which is the intellectual. But Aquinas, so that's a kind of, in a lot of sort of textbooks, that's a preferred way, sort of bottom up, to reach the intellect. But Aquinas also very frequently reaches the human intellect top down. So he puts the human intellect into what he calls an intelligible order that contains God, angels, and then the human intellect as the lowest in that order. And so maybe some of you are familiar with this formulation that he uses where he says God is ipsum esse subsistens, so subsistent being itself or subsistent existing itself. He also uses the formulation that God is ipsum intelligere subsistens, so subsistent knowing itself, right? God is a sort of pure act of knowing, right? That is what the being of God is. So there we can sort of see that you've taken this idea of this sort of pure unity of intellect and intelligibility in the human being and sort of extended that way out to say what God is just a subsistent pure act of knowing. Right, and so then we might say, whoa, how is that going to be differentiated from the way that the human being is? And he's got some different ways of sort of marking the degrees of the latter. But the fundamental idea is that it's in fact in the self-possession of our intellectual being that reflects the primary self-possession of the divine being. Okay.
Thank you. So that's one question, and I think it's similar to Ben's. So the example that you gave about the spider, that seems to be inner sensation.
Yes.
In the same way that when I'm talking about the table, that's inner sensation,
yeah,
because dogs have that, all non-rational animals, many of them have the same memory as well. So, which, as you mentioned, that's why many other philosophers put memory there. So that thing in itself, the sensible, seems to still be the matter.
Yeah.
Right? I am assuming Aquinas doesn't really want to have the sensible being the sensation. So the critique that you were saying, like, oh, there are many scientists who they believe that the thing is in the object, I think he still allows the fact that all of us will look at the table and look at the same thing. Then that's the sensible.
Oh, yeah.
So the intellect in itself seems to be building on that in a way. So how exactly is the connection between the sensible, the sense, the intellect, and especially the inner sensible,
right,
the particular relevant pieces?
Yeah, thank you. So, right, so one of the possibly confusing things about the example is that when we have experiences of intense concentration, they tend very much to be visual or auditory experiences. And so those are the ones that are easiest to illustrate the kind of intense attention, but nonetheless framed by self-awareness. But it is the case that if we're to illustrate intellectual engagement with the spider, I can't just be staring at it. I also in some way have to be grasping it as a spider. Right, so I have to be recognizing it, oh dear, that's a spider. And if I do that, then my intellect is engaged sort of classifying it as a kind. So sense and intellect are both involved in that experience. So then I might say, okay, well, what exactly is being engaged with there in the spider? Sense and intellect. And sense is engaging with the material properties of the spider, and the intellect is engaging with the essence of the spider. Now, the properties of the spider, its texture, the color, the shape, are all properties that are in the spider. And that's also true of the essence. The spiderness of the spider is also in the spider. And that's where I think there's then some confusion in Aquinas' vocabulary that's led to some ambiguities in the way that people read the text. Because it's very natural to say, Aquinas thinks the essence of the thing is in the spider. The essence of the spider is in the spider. Aquinas also says that essences are intelligible. So that means the intelligible is in the spider. But if we look at his terminology carefully, he's very careful to say that what's in the spider, the essence that's in the spider, is only potentially intelligible. So it's there as a material reality structuring the spider.
As a sensible.
Yes.
So the sensible is in the object.
He'll even make that distinction when he's talking about the sensible. So he thinks that in the color in the spider is a non-sensing color. It's not identical with sense. But in the eye, the color of the spider is identical with the act of seeing. So you're going to have the same sort of equation that goes on in sensing, where the sense is identical with the sensible in actuality, but in the eye. And intellect is identical with the intelligible, again, in me, but not there. That makes sense.
But then you put the harm, right? Isn't benefit and harm something that detection of benefit and harm comes from the inner sensation?
Yeah.
That cannot just be the combination of the colors. It has to be the recognition that thing I'm looking at is a spider. So it has to be a recognition. Oh. Like when a dog barks at a snake,
it's
not barking at a random animal that could be nearby. It's barking at something that it considers to be dangerous. So it's categorized in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not that the spider beat the dog, therefore the dog. No, it's a preemptive. So it has to be that the dog is recognizing, as you mentioned, the harm. And this is not intelligible. It is something. And the only way you can recognize the harm, I assume, in a spider or in a snake, is by realizing it is a spider. So it is a category, it is a form.
So this is where, Aquinas is going to draw a distinction between classifying, properly speaking, and grasping the nature of the thing. So he thinks that animals, through the inner senses, do definitely classify. When the wolf apprehends the sheep as to be eaten, right? It's precisely as a member of a class, right? And so he says there is, in a way, a kind of universal, even in the inner sense, already. And that's something that's widely accepted at the time. It's like a sort of quasi-universalizing move that's happening, that's a classifying move. But he distinguishes that from, properly speaking, the grasp of the nature of the thing. So what Aquinas would say is the wolf does not grasp the sheep as sheep. If it did, then it could ponder, what is a sheep? Does a sheep have dignity? Should I eat a sheep? But it doesn't ask those questions, right? Yeah, it's not asking about what a sheep is, because the sheep doesn't show up to it like that. It just shows up to it under these sort of practical classifications as having certain properties and being able to run away. This one's, you know, can run faster than that one, so I should grab that one. It's to be eaten, right? So it shows up not as having a nature, but as classifiable according to certain visual or sensible properties.
Yeah. So member of a category without the category in itself being accessible.
Yes, and I think we have this problem when we're talking about universals in Aquinas, we often sort of just assume, oh, he's talking about just categorizing, right? And it's a sort of easy shortcut, and I may have actually used that shortcut. But technically speaking, he makes a distinction between grasping the universal and categorizing.
I think we have time for one more question.
Going back to the part of the talk about the spooky body, has there ever been any empirical evidence that validated the existence of a ghost or other properties that are sometimes manifested in so-called haunted houses? Or can it be said that people who experience those things are imagining them, or their subconscious is at work involved? Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, so if you have a spooky body kind of notion of immateriality, then you might think, well, I mean, we should be able to detect it somehow. You could sort of go around hunting for evidence, but using some kind of like method of like a magnetic detector or things like this. And I think for Aquinas, he definitely thinks that there are sort of apparitions to a human being of some, let's say, one of the primary cases were scriptural cases where an angel appears to someone. He thinks what's happening there is that the angel is causing some kind of impression to appear on our sensory faculties, right? Or possibly in the imagination. So it's not like, so for Aquinas, an immaterial entity cannot be registered by the methods that we use to register extended stuff, right? But nonetheless, they can appear to us as though they were extended by sort of just brute force exercising causal power on our sensory faculties. So there's not really a body there, but we're having an experience as though there was a body there. So in Tobias and the angel Raphael or something like that, he thinks that's the sort of thing, this sort of mechanism.
Yeah, I was thinking of the idea of people claiming that they have seen the specters moving at night through a cemetery, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and so Aquinas would say if that's actually a real experience, then it's happening because there's some kind of immaterial substance that's acting on the sensory faculties, but not because there's actually something out there that is a spooky body that we could sort of then use some other method to detect. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, we'll finish.
Thank you.